This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more at robertaspizza.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, and welcome to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Elena Santigade, and listeners, this is our 400th episode of Cutting the Curd. Woo! I'm excited to be co-hosting the show today with longtime Cutting the Curd book review host Diane Stemple.
Hello.
And we have a special guest with us here in the studio. Our guest today really needs no introduction, so I'll keep this brief. The mystery guest is the owner of one of New York City's cheese shop institutions. She is a true artisan cheese pioneer, perhaps most known for bringing high-quality American-made cheeses to New York City chefs and revolutionizing the New York restaurant cheese board with local options. She was also the original groundbreaking host of this very podcast, our beloved Cutting the Curd. Anne Saxelby, welcome back to Cutting the Curd.
Oh, thanks, guys. So excited to be here.
You're very welcome.
Yes, this is
400
such a treat.
Shows. That's so crazy.
That's nuts.
Yeah.
And I believe you hosted, I was trying to count, and I don't have an official count, but I think you hosted something like 175 or almost 200 shows.
Something like that. Yeah.
Wow.
It was a long time.
Yeah. A lot. So... And also, Heritage Radio Network is celebrating our 10th anniversary, and Cutting the Curd was one of the founding shows of the radio network, I believe, also.
Did Patrick talk you into it right away?
Yeah, I mean, that's like, it's kind of how we met, which is so funny. So I had originally come out to Roberta's to be on Zach Palaccio and Jory MD's show, which was called Urban Foragers.
Mm-hmm,
and so it was me and Ronnie Sue from Ronnie Sue's Chocolates in the Essex Market. And it was like ladies of the Essex Market. I think they were really like hurting for material.
They're like, but, we need guests.
Yeah. So we came out here and I was just like, what is this place? And then Patrick happened to come by after the show, and I had never met him before, but I had heard his name a lot because of Slow Food and the radio, et cetera. And he said, oh, well, we really want to have a cheese show on the network. And I was thinking to myself, I was like, yeah, right. I was like, no way I have time for that. And like, you know, what is this crazy pizza place I'm standing in? But I'm very bad at saying no to things. So I said, I said, well, okay, maybe, you know, let's talk about it. And so, you know, we went out for a beer and talked about it. And then, you know, now whatever.
Now they're married.
Now you're married.
10 years later, we have three kids. And, you know, and Cutting the Curd is still on the air, which is so awesome.
Wow. So you started the show before you started going out?
Kind of was like the same time.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, it's a convenient date. You know, he knows she's going to be here recording the show, maybe show up, say hello.
And to woo me in the early days, he would always, we didn't have a theme song, so he'd always pick a different like sports theme song to play as the intro. So one week it was like Monday Night Football.
Oh,
and like the next week it was like the Olympic theme song. And
did that get you?
Yeah. I was just like, who is
this
weirdo?
Were you baffled by it?
Yeah, I was like baffled and amused and just kind of like, this is totally ridiculous. So
what were the early days like when you were recording the show? So you're kind of jumped into it. You think, I'll try it out.
How many shows were there at first?
Yeah.
At first, I can't remember. There might have been like 10 or something like that, 8, 10.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. I was really excited about it from the get-go because, I mean, there's just so many interesting people to talk to. I remember my first guest was this guy, Bill Stligson, who I...
That's a tricky name.
It was a tricky name, and he is from Wisconsin, and he and I were co-judges at the ACS that year, which was my only year judging. And I was just so impressed by him because he had kind of grown up in... you know, as a cheesemaker in Wisconsin and wound up being a cheese grater. But he was really, he was, when he was on the show, I don't know what his age was, but he was probably in his like early 70s, I want to estimate. And so his career in the cheese world had really like spanned so many generations, you know, right. And his family had grown up in the dairy business. Mm-hmm. And so he remembered like the Rural Electrification Act that wow. really changed cheese making in Whoa. Wisconsin. And I was just like, wow, that's amazing.
That is a history that we'd want to record.
Yeah. I never even heard of the Rural Electrification Act.
Yeah.
It was well, like you can imagine what it did.
Exactly. Right. Changed yeah. cheese making. It yeah. wasn't yeah. fire anymore. Yeah. It was, you know, electricity.
Yeah. Very interesting. So how did you plan those early shows? So you had you wanted to interview a lot of people. There was a lot to do. How did you get your mind around planning for the show?
Oh my God. I like totally didn't. I was just like, you know,
Did you have help?
No, I didn't have help back in the early days. So it was
she
just
was
like,
running a cheese store. You'd already opened the warehouse?
Opened the warehouse, I think. No, 2009. Yeah, so it wasn't even yet. Yeah, we didn't open the warehouse until 2011. So I was like coming over here.
Oh, so you only had one store. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, that's good.
But, you know, it's like, you know, being a business owner, you like wear all the hats anyway. So I was probably in the midst of like ordering cheese or talking to customers, you know, I'd like find a guest and then just like kind of bike over here and think about what I wanted to say.
A customer could be a guest.
And customers were guests. Yeah, I remember I had this guy, Patrick, on. I did a little series about cheese and the arts. And so we did one about painting because I have a fine art background. Mm-hmm. And so we talked about like cheese and you know, Dutch still lives and things like that. We had an art history professor on. And then we did Patrick, my customer from the Essex Market. He was a theater person and he's Irish. So we talked about James Joyce and cheese.
Because
like cheese figures like in some kind of really graphic, you know, descriptions of food and Ulysses and this and that. So I don't know. All kinds of crazy things.
You mentioned that you would think about the show. You'd like prepare for the show on the bike ride over. I love that. As like a mental space to be like, okay, wait, what am I doing? How do I change gears from all this stuff I'm working on in the shop and then go ask a bunch of questions of someone?
Totally.
Did it work?
Biking How much is like, prep did you do?
You know, not too much. Maybe like a half hour of prep beforehand. I mean, you guys are pros. I was just kind of winging it. I'd come in here and just like, you know, hope to, you know, chat with people and have an interesting conversation.
Did you imagine it would last 10 years?
I mean, I'm really impressed to see.
Did Patrick imagine it would last, Heritage Radio would last 10 years?
I think so. I think Patrick is like, he's like a movement guy, you know.
Uh-huh.
He's
visionary.
Always,
uh-huh.
Yeah, he's always thinking about like kind of, you know, his legacy and the future and what is going to happen to an organization. I think that probably came from working with Carla Petrini and kind of seeing how Slow Food has, you know, grown over the years and how important that mission is. So, but to think that Cutting the Curd is now 10 years in is so cool. And to like think of all the people who've listened in over the years or been on the show or, you know, it's really special.
Yeah. Do you have any episodes that like thinking back on, especially the early days, any memorable moments, good or bad?
You're right. I want to know, what were your favorite shows and what were your biggest challenges?
Oh my gosh. That's a really good question.
Well, having me on was one of your favorites.
Of course.
That's always a challenge, I would say.
No, I was great.
And you still are, Diane. No, you're so good. I'm really happy. We had, I got to have Daphne Zeppos on the show.
Nice.
Which was super special. Yeah. So that was probably one of my favorite episodes. As far as challenging ones, I remember being on the phone with a few people who are just really quiet, you know, and like,
oh, did you do phone interviews also?
I did a lot of phone interviews. Yeah, just because it's hard to find a lot of people locally,
especially
you know?
With the cheesemakers. Like for me, I think of those early years, especially as this like almost encyclopedia of American cheesemaking at that time. Like there aren't a lot of accounts from the cheesemakers that you spoke with in those early years. So they're far away.
Yeah, exactly. And they're very busy. So, you know, it's like, it was,
For them to give you a half hour was all they could offer.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So what did you, it sounds like you didn't have a whole lot of expectations going into it. Were there elements of hosting the show that surprised you in terms of things that you enjoyed about it or things that felt more stressful? Or,
well, I always felt stressed out because I was always underprepared, you know. So I was just like, "Oh my God, here we go again!" Like,
yeah, you didn't sound. Nobody knew
because you're so relaxed.
Well, I guess I guess that's good. If I could fool everybody, but no, I was definitely always stressed out about like coming up with, you know, with enough content and doing justice to the guests. Cause you know, of course you want to ask people like good questions have a relevant conversation and not just, be like chatting, you know, amongst the two of you. Mm-hmm. But the thing that was most rewarding was probably just how the show encouraged me to keep learning. Mm-hmm. And I feel like in cheese, you know, it's like the more you know, the more you don't know. And I mean, whatever, I'm 16 years into selling cheese now. I mean, Diane and I met behind the cheese counter at Murray's in 2003.
Yeah.
And thinking about like, you know, just all of the things that you have to learn if you have to come up with, you know, with more ideas and more shows to talk about and more people to talk to. Mm-hmm. And I think that was nice too, just staying connected to the kind of cheese community at large.
Yeah.
It was a really great way to stay connected and kind of know what was going on.
Mm-hmm. At some point, Sophie Schlesinger joined you as a producer, and sometimes she would co-host shows with you, right?
Yes, Sophie and I met, I can't remember what year it was. She started off as like an intern for Saxelby Cheese, and then she's just such an awesome person, and she was so organized and so detail oriented and so fun to work with that we worked together in a more formal way. And she worked with us, I think, for about 3 years probably. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then she really took ownership of kind of producing the show and getting in touch with the guests. And, and then once Sophie became involved, then things kind of became a little bit more
organized.
Yes, definitely. Official. Yeah, Sophie is so awesome. And so she really kind of took the show to the next level. And then I feel like, you know, then when I had my son Max, that's when I kind of decided I had to take a little break. And
now, what year did you have Max?
In 2012.
Is that when I started?
And that's when you started.
Because I approached you at a party here at Roberta's, and you hadn't yet thought of maternity leave for the show.
Classic
and business
owner.
I just got this bee in my bonnet saying, oh, I'll take over the show for you. And you like looked at me like, oh, that's a good idea.
Totally. And yeah, otherwise I was probably like, how can I like breastfeed in the studio with like crying baby, which I'm sure I probably did once twice.
Well, you didn't know what a crying baby was like then.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now I know all too well. No. but yeah, then you guys stepped in, and then Greg Blaze hosted for a little while, and he was super, super great too, and brought a whole other experience to the show, because his experience in the cheese world is so rich, and he's like an old school guy.
Yeah,
and
there aren't many stories.
Who kind of came up during those years that he did, and kind of seeing things from going like the wild, wild west of kind of people being able to import whatever they wanted, and the early days of Dean and DeLuca, and not Balducci's. There was another one on Sixth Avenue that was like smaller.
I'm going to blank on it. It's like on the tip of my tongue. This is going
to
come to me.
Well, it'll come, but he worked there too. And so it was just like, he saw all these like, you know, awesome, like raw milk, crazy kind of cheeses that would all be like contraband today, like up until now. But he was still able to like maintain certain connections through the years. And like he had his buddies who could get stuff to him. So he was a journalism major too. Mm-hmm. So I feel like the show has been like a great platform for a lot of different people over the years to kind of, you know, get in here and, you know, use their expertise and also educate tons of people in the process, which is so cool.
Right.
So you decided to take a step back when Max was born. And was that when you were...
That was only 2-3 months.
Right.
And then you came back.
And then I kind of decided, oh my God.
You had a lot going on.
Yeah. And that's when, Diane and I and Greg talked about then kind of,
making the shift.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I started doing the books because I needed to stay with the show. And I knew Anne couldn't read books with 2 children by then, and a cheese shop. Mm-hmm. So I figured, I'll read the books.
You'll read the books.
That's awesome.
It worked out.
Yeah, totally.
Wow. So then when you had a little distance from the show, how did you relate to it? Would you feel weird on Mondays? Or I guess it may not have always been on Mondays, I'm realizing. But
I think it was always on Monday.
It was always.
Okay. Was it an adjustment not doing the show for a while? Or
you know, I'm kind of a weirdo about stuff like this, but then once I'm like done doing something, I was just kind of like, okay.
Yeah.
Like I'm done.
Yeah.
And there's always something there to fill that time, you know? So I feel like if anything, I was probably just happy to get home a little earlier for the kids, you know, and then just be like, oh, okay. You know?
Totally.
Yeah.
Well, actually it's time for a quick break. So let's jump into it.
Okay.
We'll be back in a moment for more cheese industry reflections with the original Cutting the Curd host, Anne Saxelby.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Join Heritage Radio Network on Monday, November 11th for a raucous feast to toast a decade of food radio. Our 10th anniversary Bacchanal is a rare gathering of your favorite chefs, mixologists, storytellers, thought leaders, and culinary masterminds. We'll salute the inductees of the newly minted HRN Hall of Fame, who embody our mission to further equity, sustainability, and deliciousness. Explore the beautiful Palm House and Yellow Magnolia Cafe, taste and imbibe to your heart's content, and bid on once-in-a-lifetime experiences and tasty gifts for any budget at our silent auction. Tickets available now at heritageradionetwork.org/gala.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd. I'm Elena Santigate, and I'm here with Diane Stemple and Anne Saxelby. So since we're doing this milestone-focused show today, I thought it would also be fun to talk about your professional experience, Anne, and how things have gone for you in this past decade, sort of even separate from the show, and also think about some of your ideas and thoughts on the cheese industry of the future. So Saxelby Cheesemongers, starting with the shop. You actually recently had a huge shift from east side to west side.
Yes.
You're originally located in Essex Market, which had a long, drawn-out process of changing locations, ultimately. And then alongside that, you ended up moving to Chelsea Market on the west side. And so how has that shift been for your business? I mean, you were such a sort of east side Essex Market's mainstay. We actually, just walking into the studio, ran into somebody who knew Anne from the from the Essex Market. How has it been being in a new location after all this time?
It's been good. It's been really interesting. I mean, the Chelsea Market and the Essex Market couldn't be more different. You know, the Essex Market was a really, and you know, since it's moved, it's like a little less gritty, you know, but
oh,
it's
way less gritty. I just went there.
It's very shiny
weekend.
Now.
Yeah, it's very shiny, very new, but still, you know, by and large, the same collection of kind of, you know, quirky like mom and pop vendors. But the Chelsea Market is just a real, you know, it's a real tourist destination. There's a ton of people going through there all the time.
Packed. It's so packed.
Yeah. It's almost
like
a problem how packed it is.
For cheese?
People come downstairs for cheese. I feel like they need to do like a neighborhood like public service announcement to tell people all the secret ways into the Chelsea Market, because there are like millions of them. It's really interesting.
Interesting.
On 15th and 16th Street, if you're ever in the neighborhood, there are all these little doors that you can go in.
I've gone out one of those and I've been like, where am I? I'm outside and I don't realize where.
Exactly. Yeah, there are so many like that. So they're going to kind of create a dedicated staircase on 15th Street that will bring people right downstairs to the grocery area, which I think is good. No, it's been really fun. And it's like, you know, the store at the Chelsea Market is bigger. It's 350 square feet as opposed to 100 square feet.
It's huge. This is a 300% increase.
Yeah. Store.
Yeah, the Essex Market
store
was so tiny.
How often do you go there versus the warehouse?
I'm usually at the warehouse these days. I usually go to Chelsea at least once a week to kind of check in with Jill, who's our manager over at the shop. She's really awesome. And just kind of see how everything is going. Then otherwise, I'm at the warehouse or I'm visiting chefs or, you know, planning like mail order stuff. I don't know. I'm trying to do too many things. Still wearing many hats. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Now, what percent do you now have of European cheese versus American cheese?
Well, at the shop, we still sell 100% American cheese.
No Parmesan?
Well, that's true. 99.9. Yeah, no. Parmesan and Pecorino Romano. We sell at the shop. Okay. You know, it's funny. There's still no domestic equivalent to those cheeses. It's just like not.
That's true.
It's you not can't happening. Do it. And then we carry for wholesale. We have a small selection of French cheese from Hervé Mons, who, you know, was one of my mentors, and it's just. Basically does what we do, but in France, you know, they work with a collection of, you know, of farmers who make these cheeses, and then they sell them to us.
I didn't know if it had increased in the...
No, we're kind of keeping the scope similar. And the American stuff is still all from east of the Mississippi. Which, you know, it's kind of started off as like no cowgirls, no Rogue River, which is such a bummer because they just won.
Especially right now, yeah.
Oh my gosh, yeah. But all those cheeses are so great, but I feel like it's as far away as Europe.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's true. It's a really good point.
Yeah. So I don't know. We might go there one day. I'm not totally writing it off, but yeah, for now it's still East Coast-ish.
Mm-hmm. How has your role at Saxelby Cheesemongers changed over time? Like, it sounds like you're still doing a lot of different things, but are there certain areas that you make sure that you're still involved in because you love them, or certain areas you're sort of happy for somebody else to do after so much time?
Oh man, I don't know. I feel like, I was not like an inherently good manager. So it was like a tough transition to go from like just being the sole employee in the store who was there, you know, 6 days a week, 11 hours a day, to then kind of having a team. Our team is still small. I think we've got like 10 people.
Yeah. Small team.
But so kind of learning how to, I don't know, be a little bit better manager and pass along the knowledge, you know, that I've gotten about certain producers or certain products, or creating systems so other people have access to all the right information. Mm-hmm. I think, how the role has changed. Because it's like, I still want everybody to, you know, to know all the things about the cheesemakers. Right. At the end of the day, that's what counts the most. It's like, we want to be the bridge between the farm and the people loving the cheese. And so in order for that to happen, everyone who works with us has to know as much as they can about it. Luckily, you know, we've got a bunch of like, you know, nerds, and I think that they would appreciate, you know, I mean that only as the highest compliment, but we have a bunch of cheese nerds working with us. And so everybody's like hungry for that.
Really into
info
it.
Too, knowledge. Which is great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You also have a pretty robust website and like way of dispelling information online. I feel like your site was one of the first ones that had the library of cheese sort of selections on there, and has it's a great resource for just checking out different facts and stuff on the cheeses. Was that something that you did, or was it a collective effort?
That's basically been me over the, you know, it's like started off with these cheese descriptions, like in a Google Doc, whatever, how many years ago, we just like keep adding to it every time we brought on something new, until now it's like, you know, it's quite a lot of different kinds of cheese. So yeah, I still really enjoy like doing the, you know, a lot of the writing, and kind of, you know, just try again. It's like all about education at the end of the day. Yeah. It's like, that's why I got into it. I wanted
telling
to
that
like
story.
Get people excited about all these local cheeses. And so however we can get the information out there and make it easier for people to get that, you know, it's a, and
the
better.
Do the cheesemakers come to you or do you have to seek them out?
It's kind of, it's a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. I feel over the years we've had more people kind of, you know, coming to us, as more people have gotten started in the industry and, you know, have been starting cheese making and starting farms. But then occasionally we'll hear about people and want to, you know, get in touch with them. For example, there's a little farm up in northern Vermont called Barn First Creamery. And they were customers of ours at the Essex Market.
Oh, wow.
And
customers, and they bought
like
cheese.
They lived in New York on the Lower East Side.
Yeah. And
and they went to Vermont to make cheese?
Yes. They moved to Westfield, Vermont. I mean, it's totally bonkers. So the couple, their names are Merlin and Rebecca. And Rebecca was from New Jersey, but Merlin was originally from Westfield, Vermont, the same town that Lazy Lady
is
in.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's another cheesemaker that is in Westfield, Vermont.
And Lainey from Lazy Lady Farm was actually, she used to castrate pigs for Merlin's dad.
Wow.
And was like a sometime lumberjack. Oh my God. Lainey is like, is such an incredible woman.
I did not know. I knew that she had many talents, but I did not know that she castrated pigs.
There's nothing that she can't do as far as I'm concerned. And so anyways, they moved up there and started a farm. And I forget how like I learned that. But then like that was an example of like somebody that I stalked where I was like, I can't believe you guys did that. Like, I want to buy your cheese. What's going on?
Totally.
Yeah. It might have even been Lainey who told me that she was trying to make cheese.
That's so wild.
So, yeah.
And is it good?
It's very good. They're doing goat cheese.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, Lainey gave them, in quotation marks, slash was kind of like, here,
goats?
Take these goats. I don't want to call them. They're part of my family, but they're not productive for me anymore, or productive enough for me anymore, so I'm giving them to you.
Oh, great.
And then as it happens with goats, 2 becomes 4, becomes 10, becomes like 60, you know, before you know it. So, yeah, so they're great. But, yeah, there's a lot of, I don't know, there's a lot of great new cheesemakers around.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah.
How do you find out about new cheesemakers? What do you think is the, is there a way, is there sort of a channel that you plug into in terms of people you talk to or ways that you keep an eye out for new products or new cheesemakers to work with?
I feel some people get in touch with us. Mm-hmm. And then there's ACS, which is always great, you know, for kind of learning about new cheesemakers.
Yeah.
So going to the conference every year is fun. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of see what's new there. Also the cheesemakers themselves. I feel like the cheese world is still so kind of open and everyone wants to kind of promote each other. So if somebody is doing something good, you know, they'll get the word out. Also sometimes our customers who go upstate, got retail customers
Have a house upstate or
homes,
something.
Or they like to go to certain areas, they'll be like, oh, you should try the cheese from this, that, or the other farm.
Now, are you still one of the only American cheesemaker stores?
I believe so. I mean, there are
Ann and Beecher's.
Beecher's.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think
those are the only two in the city, for sure.
Everybody else has kind of like a mix.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
amazing.
Yeah.
So
it was so unique when you started it.
Yes.
You know, it was like wild.
It's like, whoa.
A wild
how
idea.
How could you have?
And now there's so many more American cheesemakers.
I know. Well, and so many more places to buy it, which is which is great. You know, I was thinking about one of the things that I think has changed the most in the last 10 years is just is the retail landscape in general. You know, not only are there more of the big stores, like there's more Whole Foods in New York and I mean Wegmans just opened.
Yeah, now we have our Wegmans in Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn, which is super cool. I haven't been there yet, but I really want to check it out.
I went last Friday.
You did? Okay,
quick
assessment.
Before they opened.
No. They opened.
They opened on the 27th.
Yes,
oh, right. Yeah.
I bought Snoma's, the one from Murray's.
Yeah.
And I bought... let's see.
What did you think of the store experience?
Oh, amazing.
Why?
Well, I have to go back because it was a little overwhelming.
Okay.
You know.
Interesting.
And I used a cart, but I parked far away.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew I couldn't buy that much stuff. And I was in a buying mode, but I couldn't buy that much stuff.
What, you couldn't take your cart out of the store to your car?
Were you like out of the perimeter? You
parked four blocks away.
Oh, I see.
Because I couldn't find online that they had parking there.
Mm. Oh, okay.
It was all paid parking, which I wouldn't do.
Any self-respecting New Yorker would not. Yeah. Good for you, Diane.
So I parked far away. So I had to walk, which was a wonderful day, but I had to walk.
So this limited your shopping potential.
Yes.
Okay.
I could buy cheese, though. Okay. Because it's not that heavy.
But it's so true that there are these enormous stores. And then there's outside of New York, you also have like Aldi, where people shop a ton. That's a big chain. And the Kroger's growth.
There's Aldi on... Mm-hmm. In New York City? Home.
Yeah, but not in the city, is it?
No, it's in Queens.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and then there's been other, like a proliferation of small specialty mm-hmm. cheese shops, too, mm-hmm. in the last, like, 10 years or so. I was mm-hmm. thinking even just in Brooklyn, I mean, there's, you know, the Brooklyn Larder, and there's
That's
Stinky
true.
Brooklyn,
Campbell's.
And Campbell's, mm-hmm. and Foster Sundry, mm-hmm. And all these great smaller shops. And yes. also in... other places throughout the country, like in Connecticut, there's Fairfield and Darien, mm-hmm. in addition to Darien Cheese and Fine Foods, which has been around forever, mm-hmm. which right. is amazing. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, the Cheese Shop of Des Moines and Antonelli's in Austin. And I feel mm-hmm. like throughout the country, there have just been like, there's just this little explosion of like specialty
right. Yeah.
Right.
cheese shops. And then along with that, it's kind of like, is it enough to be just a cheese shop? Because mm-hmm. then you've seen some of those cheese shops shift gears yeah. and kind of become prepared food
foods,
shops.
Right, coffee, right, right. these other yeah. segments of right. the like specialty world.
And meat.
Yeah, yeah mm-hmm. sandwiches, yeah. catering, mm-hmm. this and that. So,
but you've kind of resisted that. You know, you make, do you do a sandwich in the
we
shop?
We do sandwiches.
Yeah.
But
do you feel the pressure to add like other categories, especially now that you're in a bigger, slightly bigger space?
Slightly bigger. well, we've expanded. We do like beer and cider now mm-hmm. at the mm-hmm. Chelsea Market, which mm-hmm. has been good because it's like kind of complimentary. Yeah. You do American beer and American cider.
Makes okay. total sense.
Which is fun. But yeah, you can see why people do it because mm-hmm. it is, you know, it is hard to just, you know, sell cheese and, mm-hmm. and have people come to you just for that. But I think... I don't know. I like all of my retail heroes are like just kind of like crusty and do the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, like
who are your retail heroes?
Oh, you know, like Lou DiPaolo and Charlie Sahadi and you know, Nikki Russ Fetterman from Russ mm-hmm. and Daughters and mm-hmm. you know, all these like really old school
who
New
just
York
keep
shops.
Doing that same thing. They like struck
Ken,
gold
Ken
and just
from
stuck
Darien
with it.
Cheese and Fine Foods mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. they're and his wife Tori. Yeah, it's like you just like if the quality is there, people right. will mm-hmm. come back.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'm trying to stick with. It's like you don't want to deviate too far from the mission because then you can kind of get lost in it.
I think it's such a good point because I do think one of the things I'm watching out for when I like look at the cheese landscape is like how many cheese shops are shifting away from cheese? How many of those smaller independent shops feel that they can't subsist on cheese instead mm-hmm. of doubling down on cheese and kind of like really going big with it and doing more cheese and more mm-hmm. cheese education. Mm-hmm. It does seem like the knee jerk seems to be to shift away.
Yeah.
Is there anything that in that sort of same spirit, is there anything that you're looking for as a business owner when you're kind of like trying to predict, you know, the health of the industry, the health of your own business? Like, what are you watching out for in terms of news in the cheese world?
Oh, gosh. Well, I think as far as like retail goes, I think it's just like a weird moment for retail in general, just mm-hmm. with all of the
Amazon.
Yeah. The Amazonification of everything.
Right.
I just want to like write a manifesto and like tell people and be like, do you like your community?
Right.
Then shop in your community because otherwise it's not going to be there.
Right.
Right.
And you know, I feel like it's, I mean, full disclosure, I just ordered food for my kids on Uber Eats when we were during the break because
sometimes give you away,
you just have
Anne.
No time. It's okay. I'm totally fessing up. I did it.
But we didn't tell them from where.
That's beside the point.
Yes.
But moving on.
Yeah, we don't
That's
need
true.
To.
That's true. That's true. But so it's like, yeah, I do that sometimes. But I don't shop on Amazon. I've made a point that I don't shop on Amazon.
I don't either.
And anyways, I just feel like that's kind of the biggest existential threat because people's time is their most valuable commodity.
Right.
And so it's like, how does everyone spend their time? And everybody has less time, it would seem, to kind of do their food shopping or, you know, it's all that has been replaced by something else. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, what has it been replaced
by? Facebook or Instagram or email.
I do think it's been replaced by things that are less nourishing than time spent shopping at a local retailer and connecting with a human
and having
being.
A conversation. Yeah. And, right. Oh, my gosh, right. Having to wait in line for a second and be a little annoyed about it. But, then maybe it's not the end of the day.
And then maybe you chat with somebody while you're in line or you get involved in something. I sometimes force myself, even if I'm just on the subway, I'm like, I'm just going to sit here and
unplug.
Look at people and see me what too. I see, right. You know, because
you can miss some really good stuff.
Exactly.
Right.
Especially in the city.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
there's so much good stuff. Today on my way here, I saw a family all wearing matching flannels and they were like such a unit.
What color flannel?
Well, it was sort of like a greenish blue, but like, cool. I mean, this was four different people wearing the matching flannels.
That's awesome.
I know.
Are they tourists, I wonder?
They seemed, you know, I was like, okay, how much are they falling on the subway? You know, as the subway starts and stops, you can tell. Right. Do they anticipate the movement of the train? Uh-huh. And they were anticipating it pretty well. So I thought maybe they're not tourists.
Okay.
So another retail hero who I forgot to mention, who has, he passed away last year, which was really sad, but Kenny Shopson, who's the owner of Shopson's.
Your former neighbor.
My former neighbors in the Essex Market.
Okay, for our listeners who don't know about Kenny, how do we briefly describe him?
Oh my gosh.
Well, his store.
Yeah, Kenny had a store in the West Village that turned into a restaurant, and he basically raised his five kids there with his neighborhood, because their original store was on Morton and Grove, and Morton Street was like their world, and he just kept, talk about doubling down on what you do.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
He dug his heels in like a lunatic.
He doubled down.
He had a very big menu.
His menu was huge. Yeah, the menu was set in like, you know, 7-point type. The menu was huge. He was just like, you know, a kind of armchair philosopher. Mm. And, you know, but his customers were his family and vice versa. And so if you kind of, you know, broke one of kind of the many unwritten rules of the restaurant, you'd be unceremoniously like thrown out on your butt.
Kicked out.
Yeah.
My mom once went with a friend who was close with Kenny, also a regular at Ann's shop.
With Aaron?
With Aaron Palace.
Oh my God. Yeah, Aaron.
Old family friend. Hi, Aaron.
Yeah.
And I think she just started like doing a lot of swearing to like fit in. And apparently that really worked well with Kenny. My mom was just swearing and like mucking it up, you know.
Your mom?
Yeah, she was just freaked out about getting kicked out, but I think she just thought, I'm going for it.
The more foul mouthed, you know, the better. But
he's one of your retail heroes.
And just talking about Amazon and like, you know, the devolving of kind of the sense of community, you know, that really like embodied that sense of community to me, you know, Shopson's.
Even the line outside, I mean, it was cool because if you were waiting for Shopson's, you were right outside Saxilby. And that little scene right there was sometimes really funny.
Totally. Yeah. We'd like give
and
cheese curds to the
people.
Unsuspecting, to people who are like crying children in the line for Shopson's. Give everybody some cheese curds. So
what do you think can be done to preserve it? Or should we think differently about the future? Yeah.
I don't know. I wonder if New York will go through another period where like rent gets really low because right now there are a lot of empty storefronts.
Yeah,
that's true. Know?
That's kind of my dream.
Yeah, the commercial
like
rent.
If rent is cheap, then people will open businesses. And it seems like people are craving that community. Like I was talking to someone about this, you know, and places that are retail places, but that are also community places like Books or Magic on Smith Street.
Yes,
or
perfect example.
They're kind of like these like knitting or sewing places that are kind of community places where you can go and buy something, but you could also go and like
hang out,
a book or get advice on your knitting project or whatever. And people are really like seeking those places out.
Yeah.
And so I feel like
in real life, more.
Yeah, I feel like there's, I don't know, it's almost like a shift of like, okay, you have to have like great products and you have to have a well-curated selection, but you also have to have a reason for people to go there and a reason for and kind of, you know, have that sense of community and like, why are people coming to you? Why are they hanging out?
Right.
Give them more of a reason to.
Right.
You know?
I like it.
So I don't know.
I'll be happy to see rents go down. I think that's great. Right?
I think there was an article in the real estate section Sunday about rents falling on two bedrooms.
Oh, now we're talking residential. Well, this is a whole other show.
Yeah, totally.
All right. Well, I can't believe it, but we're getting close to the end of the episode. Any final questions for Anne, Diane?
Well, I had my paranoid question about what's going to happen. I've read about meat and cheese being paired as environmentally incorrect.
Yes. Hmm.
Now, so what's your actual question? Not artisanal cheese.
You're saying big dairy is getting lumped in with big ag meat. And big meat as an environmental
hazard
in this climate conscious.
Well, because there have been a lot of non-meat burger articles.
Oh, yes. The Beyond Burger and Impossible Burger.
It's a big deal.
Do your customers...
cheese is put in the same category. It's sort of lumped in. Because it comes from cows.
It's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I feel like, you know, with anything else in agriculture, it's like if you put back what you take out and you kind of can only get to a certain size.
Right.
With cows, it's putting poop back in on the field, and not collecting poop in places where then it's going to turn into noxious gas that, you know, leaches out into the atmosphere.
It is the poop that is the problem.
The poop is the problem.
Yeah.
And so if you're pasturing your animals and you have an operation like Uplands Cheese or, you know, et cetera, where your animals are out on pasture, then you're just spreading all that fertilizer around essentially and sequestering more carbon and building your soil. Right. So I feel like big dairy should go out of business.
Mm-hmm. Ah,
I drove from LA to San Francisco and I saw all those giant dairies in the desert in California.
It's weird.
And you're just like, no. That should not be happening.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, it's weird.
And I feel like it's so strange because it's not only domestically, but then, you know, dairy on giant scale in other parts of the world is depressing milk prices across the board. So I would be fine to see a lot of big dairies go out and go back to a time where you had smaller family farms, more local processing, and everybody could make a buck doing it.
And but where I don't know if the people can... think in those terms.
Well, of course they can, but it is a sort of media angle that needs to, you know, it's a nuance. This is more of a nuance.
Well, so at the ACS conference in July, I went to the seminar. There was a seminar on like what's happening with milk and milk alternatives, because like soy milk, oat milk, etc. And everyone's in the dairy industry is freaking out about like the specter of soy milk and oat milk. And here we are in the studio with an Oatly poster behind us. But, you know, basically the thesis was the thing that took up the majority of sales from milk was bottled water.
It's so interesting.
Nut milk made it like up a paltry like 4%.
Huh. Right.
But so I feel like, I don't know. I feel like the consumer too, it's like the meat companies have done such a good job of making, or the Beyond companies have made such a good job of making tasty things that actually taste like meat. And we were talking about this a little before the show. I have yet to taste a vegan cheese that tastes anything like cheese.
It's true. It's not the same. It's not in the same ballpark at all.
And so I feel like, I don't know, Patrick and I, my husband and I have this conversation a lot too, because he sells meat for a living. And I feel like people should... overall, eat less meat and less cheese. They should just pay more for it.
And they should
eat
the good stuff. Right. They should eat it from more higher quality sources.
You know, back in the day, people weren't having meat every day. They weren't having, in France, I guess you would have cheese every day. Or if you lived on a dairy farm, you'd have cheese every day. But, you know, I feel like if you're doing it well, it's going to cost a little bit more to produce it. And
I think it comes down to a assumption of the food cost being skewed. Like this assumption that food should be the cheapest thing we buy and that somehow it should still be good and good for the environment is...
The math doesn't work out.
The equation's busted,
And back at, you know, in the early 1900s, I remember reading that people spent about 10% of their income on food. And now people, they think they spend like 3% of their income on food.
Right.
And everything's gotten cheaper, but with that, the quality suffers, the environment suffers.
Yeah, so I think your media angle, Diane, that people could comprehend would be about food quality.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Which is hard to quantify, though.
It is.
Yeah, so.
It gets messy. Well, wow. I can't believe it. 400 episodes.
400 episodes. Yay! Congratulations.
Thank you, Anne Saxelby, for founding Cutting the Curd here at the Heritage Radio Network.
Thank you guys for keeping the torch going.
Welcome.
And thanks to everyone who has been a part of the show in the past, mm-hmm. from Sophie to Greg Blaze to Emily Acosta. I mean, it's been an amazing crew who has put this show together over the last decade. Diane is having a little bit of a coughing fit there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Listeners, we hope that you liked this week's show. Diane and Anne, thanks again so much for joining me here in the studio.
Thanks, Elena.
We won't have an episode next week, everyone, because we will be partying at the Heritage Radio Network's 10th anniversary gala on Monday, November 11th. We'll be at the Palm House and Yellow Magnolia Cafe at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, and you can party with us. Tickets are still available at heritageradionetwork.org/gala, and you can use the code CUTTINGTHECURD, no spaces, for 10% off. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with more Cutting the Curd. Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.